1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
JVD Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. Yesterday, we were horrified to hear that there was yet another mass shooting in these United States. It took place in Atlanta, and the details were sketchy in the beginning. We heard it was 6 people, then we heard it was 7, and then later we heard 8 people were killed. And then we were horrified to see that 6 of the people were women, and 6 of those women were Asian. This comes on the heels of large number of incidents from coast to coast of Asian people, primarily elders in the community, being attacked, some of them killed. We've had that happen twice here in the Bay Area, maybe 3 times. We've had incidents in New York. We hear them in Los Angeles. And that just seems to be the tip of the iceberg. It gets compounded because we've also had a number of folks who have been killed by police, which is problematic in itself. And we've done shows around that. And we've also seen scenarios where people in 2021 are still blaming our Asian brothers and sisters wholesale for the coronavirus. And that has been used as an excuse to levy violence on the community. But yesterday was something that was heart-wrenching, and it was heart-wrenching for those of us who are in movements and who are activists and work alongside our Asian brothers and sisters to see the agony that they're experiencing, the trauma of seeing elders who could be their grandparents and could be their aunties and uncles being attacked in these streets, and then to see this mass shooting. It becomes even more traumatic when you hear a sheriff up on the arrest of Robert Long say this man had a sex addiction, almost justifying the carnage that took place. So I wanted to bring together a number of frontline people who are doing work around these and other issues and get their perspective and really just give people an opportunity to really express the type of angst, anger, sadness that folks are feeling. We have Pastor Erna Kim Hackett. She's with the organization Liberated Together. We have Isabel Kong. She's with the Korean Resource Center out of Los Angeles and does a lot of work around sexual exploitation and human trafficking. We have, and let me just make sure I get everybody's names and everything. We have Hai Jin Shim, and I hope I pronounced that. She used to be with the Asian Women's Shelter. And we have Michelle Mush Lee, who's the Cultural Affairs Commissioner. Michelle, I want to start off with you. Yesterday, when this came out, you were in tears. You posted something on Facebook, and I think it moved a lot of people. We could feel your pain and the anger that you were feeling. And maybe we could start off with what you were sharing with us and you know, let's just get where you're at on this right now.
Thank you, Davey. And thank you to everybody that's listening. I want to start with the names of those who were lost yesterday. And I hope that I'm pronouncing this right, because this is breaking news. The names are coming out right now. So Delana Ashley Yun, Paul Andres Michael, Xiao Jin Tan, Dao Yu Feng, Julie Park, Hyunjung Park. In Asian culture, I was born in San Francisco, but we all know Asian women are taught not to stand out too much. We are taught to suppress our rage, to suppress our pain, literally to be the last at the table to eat. So yesterday, as an incredibly private person, but also as a single mother who's learned to live and protect and care for and provide for a young boy in Oakland on my own, largely, I said that because everybody who looks like me needs to see what it feels like to feel rage. And we're always taught to suppress rage. And if I've learned anything, Audre Lorde, the great late poet, said, your rage is beautiful and it's powerful. And what happens when we don't, Asian women don't express our rage, is that we internalize it, it implodes, and it turns into self-harm, whether it's in the form of suicide or other self-harm tactics. And that's the cycle I'm breaking. So it's not easy to be vulnerable on social media, but it's important because this is something that I'm trying to break culturally.
What is going on through your head when it was just 2 weeks ago, we had you on and we were talking about solidarity between Black and Asian communities, and we had this successful event, 800 people coming together, people standing in solidarity and making a commitment to each other to move forward, to see, you know, in the aftermath, you know, the killing of the 75-year-old man here, and then this.
Everything still stands true. I learned revolution. I got a call last night from a good friend, a Black woman artist in Oakland. And she said, you know, it's okay to just to have this space for you. And even then, that is an act of solidarity. A Black woman who's saying, you know what? You don't need to bring in Black people into this conversation. You can have this space because your pain and your rage is deserving of its own stage. And that solidarity still exists.
Appreciate that. Pastor Erna Kim, I want to bring you in. You're doing a lot of work as a pastor. You worked, you've seen these types of traumas. How are you feeling, and what do you think we should be looking at this moment?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Thanks for holding this space. I think the thing coming particularly from like a Christian frame is it really troubles me the way Christian theology is the engine for a lot of this white supremacist activity. So, I mean, I think we've seen a lot of discussion, but, you know, the intersection of white supremacy and white evangelicalism has given permission for a lot of violence. I think that the way that that's enacted onto the bodies and lives of Asian women, we also hit a kind of unique the fetishization of Asian women, the coming from the way American Christianity and militarism overlap to create a kind of violence against Asian women's bodies. We're seeing all of that happen. And then to have him sort of invoke, like, I have a sex addiction, and he's names himself as Christian and references a lot of things that people from Christian context would hear as purity.
You're talking
culture,
about the sheriff. You're talking about the sheriff today.
I'm talking about the shooter himself.
Oh, the shooter. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, like he names himself as being a Christian, and the way he talks about, like, and I guess it was the sheriff relaying his words, but yes, his words being like, the sex addiction, and I just need to, like, get rid of the problem. That type of problematizing of women around sexuality is part of evangelical purity culture, and it becomes one where you either control women and their sexuality or you eliminate them. And so I think we're just seeing the overlay of so many traumatic, problematic systems exploding into this kind of violence against Asian women, a group of Asian women that are typically very erased and unseen by both, like, white and Asian communities. And so I think, to me, and the other thing being that I know that Asian American women, it's not like we go to our ethnic specific church communities and then have a place where we don't experience patriarchy and silencing and erasure. It's like everywhere you go, there's silencing and erasure. And so I think really, really important to create spaces for Asian American women, for us to grieve, to take up space, to mourn, to tell our stories. Because I think viscerally, every Asian American woman, when she saw that headline, experienced it in her body as, like, profoundly personal.
Like, right.
So those are some things I'm seeing and feeling.
I appreciate that. Hi, Jin Shim. Did I pronounce your name correctly? I hope
it's
I did.
Hedgen.
Hedgen. Oh, it's one word. Okay. Sorry about that. The work you do at the Asian Women's Shelter, I want to try and bring that angle into this. You know, the women that, to my knowledge, they were working at these parlors, these massage parlors, and there's a stigma that automatically goes to that. Some people justify what happened to them. Well, they shouldn't have been there. Oftentimes that's erased. And then it's complicated by people who fetishize, you know, on Asian women. And so that's a whole other dynamic. The work that you're doing and have done with women and women's shelter, how does, you know, what angles are you looking at with respect to this tragedy?
Thanks so much, Davey. I think that's a great question. For clarification, I was at Asian Women's Shelter. I am currently at the Asian Pacific Institute on Gender-Based Violence, and I'm also I'm an organizer with an organization called Survived and Punished. We do advocacy work for women and survivors of violence who are arrested or criminalized or detained for self-defense against acts like domestic violence, sexual abuse, et cetera. So, you know, in my time working, you know, indirect services with survivors of violence, particularly Asian immigrant and refugee survivors, I think that the kind of legacy and historical context for this type of incident, for this incident specifically, has its roots both in American immigration policy, American racist policies in general, as well as American policies overseas. So when I'm talking about American policies overseas, I mean the legacies of war in the Asia, of war and occupation, continuing occupation. You know, four of the victims from last night were Korean, and the US military has had a 50 year plus presence on the Korean Peninsula, and where the military bases have formed, the exploitation and trafficking and, you know, harm, sexual violence against Korean women has proliferated. So I see this kind of in that larger historical context of, you know, the whole stereotype of like the hypersexual but submissive Asian woman. I think that is very much a legacy of American war abroad, whether that's in Korea or Vietnam or Laos or, you know, and so, you know, a lot of the Korean diaspora specifically, a lot of that migration was carried by military brides. And yeah. I think, you know, that connection between military brides and, you know, sex work in the camp towns, that is something that's such like a secret, hidden, like buried legacy of Korean diaspora. And I think, you know, there's been historically that shame, that stigma of experiencing sexual violence or for trading sex for survival, right? And so when I think of these women who were working at the massage parlors, whether or not they were actually sex workers themselves, the Asian massage parlor itself, I think, is such a site of racialized and sexualized fantasies of what an Asian woman is, what she is good for, what commodities she can produce like through her body. And and so, you know, the whole thing about framing it as like, oh, this wasn't racially motivated, you know, well, he targeted Asian massage parlors. Like, how is this not about race? How is this not about gender? And also, how is this not about class and immigration status as well? Right. Because I think, you know, one thing that gets lost in all the fray of like, you know, Asian communities like need to come together, unite against hate, is that all Asians are not the same. And the Asian women that were working at these massage parlors are primarily, you know, like non-English speaking, undocumented, might not have a ton of options, and are kind of working in very gray areas when it comes to legality. And also, like, I think, have a ton of experience with police harassment through anti-trafficking stings and operations. And so the site of the Asian massage parlor is also a criminalized site, right? So when people are talking about, oh, they need more armed guards, they need more police, I'm like, well, police are actually frequenting these massage parlors, either going undercover and having sex with the workers themselves, or like leading sting operations, arresting them. So for women who are working in the massage parlors, interaction with law enforcement is one that is always one that's leading to their criminalization. Right. So it's just like you have all these different factors of class, immigration status, race, gender, all playing in together. And I think it's a very complex picture, but I think it's also important to highlight that the women who are affected and those being affected the most by these forms of violence are the ones that are most at the margins within the broader Asian American and Asian immigrant community.
You said a lot there, and I appreciate the historical context. I think it's real important. You know, I know a lot of military folks, a lot of people, and you know, it's that open secret of the quote unquote juicies and all kind of words that are actually normalized in conversation, that, you know, when you put it in its totality, is the fetishizing of Asian women. And then this invisibilizing of them as well, the child brides and, you know, and all that sort of stuff that that goes on and nobody really wants to talk about it. So I want to put that out there, and I'm glad that you brought that context in there. Let me bring in Isabel Kang. Thank you for joining us with the Korean Resource Center. I want to kind of build off of what Haijing was talking about. And I want to look at two aspects. One, she was talking about the interaction with police, which is often problematic. We're told the police are there to protect and serve. And, you know, you're down in LA, but if I go around the corner over here to East 14th or International Boulevard, we'll see young girls, in this case, it's Black girls walking up the street. Ain't no police doing anything about that and haven't done anything about it for the 20 years I've been here. And so I bring that up to say that this human trafficking aspect seems to be one that is ripe for exploitation. And then it seems like violence. In this case, somebody got killed. I mean, six people got killed, but I would venture to guess this is not the first time violence has been waged against Asian women, especially people going to places like this, knowing darn well that they can't say anything, won't say anything. And that if they did say anything, the police are one exploiting, you know, extorting, and would probably treat them the same way they treat these sisters up on East 14th. It's like, you're on your own. And we're going to, you know, I mean, in this case, Oakland, they was taking money from them. So how are you seeing this, and how can we further contextualize what went on in Atlanta?
I think all the speakers before, in a very eloquently, every one of you have shown facets of what the problems are in this spectrum of violence, from colonization, trying not to be emotional, given what happened, but I think it's important to review some of the, it's not only the historical facts about the imperialism that America or US is still waging in the world, not only the occupation, but the continuous colonial mentality, those brothels that exist in Korea, and the constant attack on the bodies and the humanity of the women that survive under really poor conditions, many single moms. And then also one point I wanna say is about, there is the attacks and violence, but it's also not forgetting when we talk about class issues and the economical exploitation everywhere, including the Black girls that is in East 14. And I used to live in the Bay Area, the whole Telegraph, you know, and then it's called in US, it's called domestic trafficking versus the international trafficking. But it all comes to the same common thread and the reason and the origin of the problems, which is in the economical exploitation. Who is the most vulnerable person? Is not only now we have the 1900% of attacks and incidents, it is happening in focusing all Asian communities in the US, but from there, you know, the number of the attacks has been larger to almost three times on the women, the Asian women, so that we cannot separate one from the other, because it all comes again for survival, as many of said, Hejin said, but also how our society contributes, you know, all of us in terms of the mindset and the victim blaming. And remember that, you know, statistics are out there, be domestic violence, that is an issue that is so rampant that, you know, you how many you're gonna actually incarcerate all the men that abuse women in this country, you know, and but then also the number of the incidents of violence that happen in the most places are the families of a police. The cops family is the highest, and then the military families. And all that has been already recorded and seen by the people that deals with the triage work, which is the advocates, but also the nurses and medical doctors. And when they come, there is barely any help within our systems internally here. And then when, in addition to that, what the pastor Erna have mentioned earlier about the Christian beliefs that that are problematic, that is side by side with the most conservative values that have nothing to do with the Christianity that we should know, which is the love thy neighbor like yourself, but is actually the judgment first and then ostracize or the other, making the other. And then with the militarism that is still rampant, Asian women is targeted as the property of some man or the man in general. And I never forget in the 80s when I first came to this country, I was in a bus stop, and then this man start making conversation and I refused. And then he got irate and say, had not been people like me as a vet, the Vietnam vet. You, how did he call me? Gooks? You know, would not even be here. And then I realized that, you know, as a young woman in my 20s, you know, the correlation of the direct impact of the latest occupation and attacks of a nation like Vietnam, because mine was like from Korea, right? And it's a forgotten war. But let's remind what's happening right now also about the statues of the so-called comfort women, which is an euphemism for sexual slavery. And that is also under the Japanese occupation that we suffered for 35 years. And then, you know, it's the only country in the world that is attacking actually statues and monuments of victims and survivors. And then, you know, all this is pattern and a spectrum of violence against women. But, you know, then you have different facets. Every time we have an economic upheaval, and we are targeted since 1800s, this country has received or have had Asian communities living in the US. But what happened is that they were brought as cheap labor after the so-called emancipation of our brothers and sisters that were enslaved Africans that were brought here. They wanted to bring the cheapest labor to work on the railroads and whatnot. And we had, as a country, passed the legislation such as 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which is anti-immigrant, anti-people of color. And you know, this whole thing is also coming back to the most recent, the children incarcerated in those cages, the immigration, and who is, you know, so it's on and on and on. I don't want to repeat what many of us have said, but these are all the links that we cannot forget and continue demanding the stopping of the violence, but also under the past government, but even now is the allowance. I think somebody mentioned here what is permitted to happen under the media, under the policies, that attacks our communities, including our, yes, so for our survival, is we must speak up. We must find ways to have a true unity. Because the survival of all depends on us, and is not the new government didn't happen just because it was actually people like us, all our communities united to elect something or to make something feasible so we can have a breather, so we can continue working on the demands for resources for our communities,
right,
and for our children.
Isabel Kang, thank you so much for that. One of the things that is very, very apparent, and I think somebody said it, I'm not sure if it was you, Mush, or Hygiene, not everybody's the same. But in the mindset of people outside the Asian community, it's all the same. You know, Korean is Chinese, Filipino is Chinese, Japanese is Chinese, there's the model minority, you know, all that. And one thing with, you know, outside of these attacks, just seeing the number of elders that have been attacked, it's very clear that we're talking about poor people. We're talking about folks who can barely scrape probably 2 cents themselves. So, you know, I think many of us see our own grandparents, and whether we're in the community or not, because, you know, that's Mrs. Jones who, gosh, got, you know, maybe her life savings in her pocketbook, but that life savings isn't a lot. And yet those folks get exploited and attacked. And I wanted to see if we can maybe clarify and demystify some of this, because I think the stereotypes have been harmful in terms of not being able to really fully recognize what we're talking about, even probably with some of the folks who do the attacking, not to excuse their behavior, but it's probably, oh, they got money. I know they got money, you know, they're rich. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think the poverty that exists within Asian communities is something that has been adversely invisibilized, and anybody can take that and speak to that. But I think that's a big part of the, that's a big factor in some of this, when we don't see that, you know, many of you folks are struggling like everybody else, living in the hood, you know, going from paycheck to paycheck and then some. Anybody want to hit that? Maybe you, Mush, and then we'll pass it along.
Yeah, I think, you know, Asian women across all ethnic kind of groups, we still make anywhere from 43 cents to 83 cents to the dollar, to the white man's dollar. So we already know we're getting paid less, right? In the midst of this economic recession, and that's really when America's true colors show. It's when we are economically depressed that we realize, oh, there has been also a history of disinvestment in our communities, whether it's funding for public schools, whether it's cutting of arts and culture. Because I'm a poet and a cultural advocate, I always pay attention to where the money is going when it comes to schooling and when it comes to arts and culture. And those things are, of course, the first to go. Yeah. And so, you know, there's this question around what's happening. Well, what's happening is an intersection of racism, systems that separate and that tease out, because we know that there are tracks in this country. There's a reason why there's an AP calculus course. Now we're talking about education, but what I'm talking about is larger systems that continue to create the disparity of wealth. So we know that in schools there are track systems, because that reflects the economic function. There's an AP class, there's a house program, or there's the, you know, continuation school. So when you go out into the broader community to get to work, our economic structures actually reflect what's happening in our schools.
Right.
And so this is a result of that too. And we have to understand all the different complexities because it's 2021. So we have to think about economic injustice. We have to think about xenophobia and racism. We have to think about misogyny and white and patriarchy. We can't have single issue conversations. And we've been saying this again and again, but I think it's okay to say it.
Right, but those single issue conversations and somebody else jump in often result in policies. Right. And sadly, even more rhetoric. Right. So I come back to the invisibilization. Y'all are going to be all right. You know, with Black women, it's like, well, they're strong. They're from the hood, so they don't need any help. That's one way in which it's looked at. The Asian folks, it's like they got money. They're the model minority. They're good. And to show the disparities that you talked about much, you know, that becomes a problem because it's like, wait a second, you told us that everything was okay. We didn't realize that folks were living close to the edge like that. And so now we have to re-examine policies. We have to re-examine rhetoric. We have to re-examine the type of divisive positioning that some people like our mayor and others have taken, which pit communities against each other once we realize, like, damn, they living in the projects and just as poor as us. How that happened, right? Where's the money? You know, we thought you had the money. You thought we had the money. Somebody got the money, but it ain't none of us. Pastor, you wanna hit on that a little bit?
Sure, I can. And then I saw that Hidjan wanted to jump in, but I agree with what Mish is saying. You know, the model minority myth is a tool of erasure, right? And it is a tool of violence. It sounds like a compliment, but it is a tool of violence. In the same way that the strong Black woman trope is a tool of violence and silencing and erasure. You know, like Asian Americans have the highest rate of poverty in New York. Like our Southeast Asian fam, like among like Hmong folks, Cambodian folks, the rates of poverty are two to two and a half times the national average. Asian American women have experienced some of the highest jobless rates during this, you know, pandemic.
Yeah.
But all of that gets erased because of the model minority myth, which is problematic for 100 reasons, including that it's founded on anti-Blackness. And I agree. I think that it does complicate policy conversations, but I'm a big believer that like part of why I do the work with Liberated Together is I think like different ethnic communities need to have complicated conversations so that we can have radical solidarities with one another. So that when you're like, where's all the money going? White people, right? So I feel like we as people of color communities need to find ways not to erase what's different, but to understand it and understand though that we are all impacted by white supremacy, though impacted by it in different ways, but we have a shared system that we all need to dismantle and then come up and show up for each other in ways that one person's solution is not another person's problem that right. We need to, you know, and that's some of the conversation that was happening in the Bay Area where like, you can't call for like increased policing when we know policing is anti-Black, right? So that's, we have to be able to have those types of, how can we solve each other's problems together? So, and then I saw Hidjan, you were also gonna jump in on that.
Hidjan, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Erna. I think, you know, you have all brought up really great points. And what I wanted to add is that, you know, going back to your point, Davey, about class, I think class, you know, within 8 different Asian communities, class is a big buffer against racial violence. And, you know, we're not seeing like the super ultra wealthy, like living in mansions, like Asian elders being attacked. It's like Asian elders who are, you know, living, you know, like in public housing or like take public transportation, you know, are largely like located in ethnic enclaves like Chinatowns. So, I mean, I think there's a couple things where immigration policy has really affected like who comes in the country and how. So, you know, you have like very professionalized wealthy classes of people who are able to come into the United States who are seen as like kind of like the good immigrants that the US wants, like highly skilled, you know, bringing in a lot of like, just propping up, like they're selecting for the model minority within immigration policy, right? And I think you have a vast number of people who are coming in the country in different ways or who arrived in the country with a different immigration story, whether that's being a refugee or being an under the table, like restaurant worker or working, you know, in the sex trade or and so on and so forth. And, you know, with the jobs lost during COVID-19, it wasn't lost on me that the majority of them were lost by women and majority women of color. And when we think about the industries most hard hit by the pandemic, like the hospitality industry, restaurant workers, service workers of all kinds, like they've been really, really hard hit by this pandemic. And so I think about those folks who aren't eligible for a $1,400 stimulus, who aren't eligible for unemployment benefits, who aren't eligible for food aid. And so I think that issue of poverty gets buried. And it's also, I think like even within our own ethnic enclaves, there is like intra-ethnic gentrification happening. So in like Los Angeles, Koreatown, it's like big Korean companies, corporations developing and buying up properties, installing, setting up like new businesses. So it's like gentrification is happening kind of in a number of ways. But I think, when I think about Oakland and being based in Oakland, I just think about how poverty and homelessness has just skyrocketed, with the ongoing gentrification of the Bay. And I think it needs to be named that, things like gentrification and housing inequality, those things are also anti-Asian violence. Where are people supposed to go? You're like evicting people who've been living in those apartments for like so many years, and I think, I think that the tricky thing about the model minority and disputing it or agreeing with it or whatever is that, yes, it's untrue in a number of ways and has functioned in a whole other number of ways that are oppressive towards our communities, like across the board. But I think there needs to also be like holding that fact that within our communities too, we are not just one united front, but that oppression and exploitation is happening like within those two, because a lot of those restaurant workers or vulnerable people working undocumented, they are also exploited by their communities too. Yeah. It isn't just the white man, but I think we have to kind of like bring in that analysis of capitalism because people are finding vulnerability and they're exploiting it. So whether that's because the work they're doing, like in the massage parlors, might be criminalized, or they're undocumented and they are really scared of being deported, or so on and so forth.
And it leaves people ripe for violence, attack.
Yeah, so I think there's just so much there to talk about. And I think, there's like a really deep and different, there are really deep and different histories of Black and Asian disenfranchisement that look quite different, I think, but have these kind of parallel threads that I think are interesting for looking at and also for diving into to kind of help untangle some of the anti-Blackness that has really bubbled up and been fermenting for a long time within Asian immigrant communities and Asian American communities. I think all of that needs to be talked about together.
Appreciate that. I'm gonna go to you, Isabel, and I know we're getting ready to run out of time. So I wanna also, as you give your remarks, the question that I'm asking for all of y'all is what can be done to be strong allies or accomplices at this moment? What's the ask, or is there an ask to the community that are listening to help with the healing process of this horrific tragedy in Atlanta and beyond? So I'll start off with you, Isabel. Give what remarks you wanted, and then also close out with what we all can be doing at this moment.
Right. I think solidarity also means action that is based on analysis and facts and historical background. So Sunday, for example, there was a rally in Orange County in Westminster to halt the deportation of 33 Vietnamese after they paid their dues to our society here, having been also put after the 70s in places that are just not with any resources or language capacity. So I think the community is also understanding that there are other communities that it was addressed earlier by Hyejin and others, that we have different complex issues within our communities that we need to address both internally, but also when we talk about resources, housing, what is more important these days about housing? And I deal with the undocumented, especially women all the time, and many end up in this country because of abuse, domestic violence, etc. And then the criminalization that many spoke about it, but also non-access to those resources that are practically non-existent and up to eviction. So when we talk about Black Lives Matter and this, and anti-Blackness, we also dealing with people's budget and what we can affirmatively build in terms of our resources, our schools, daycare, you know, employment, and things that hold life in this planet, in this life. So the basics of any human being. So I think we got to start from somewhere. We don't have to think lofty, but I think we have to really dedicate those monies and be in the budget talks and, you know, bring those monies, you know, back to the communities that are suffering the most, and then build up from you know, the base.
Thank you. Isabel Kane with the Korean Resource Center out of LA. Thank you so much. Pastor Erna. What should we be doing at this moment? What do you think? What steps can we take?
I mean, I guess I'm gonna keep it super simple. I mean, I feel like there's still a lot of people who just aren't listening to stories of Asian Americans, or believing that violence is happening to Asian Americans, or believing that this is real harm. And so I feel like, believe it, like see it, have empathy and human compassion, which I know sounds so simple, but it's not there. And so I feel like asking for that. I think asking for people to actually interject when they see anti-Asian racism happening, whether that be just because it's, you know, it started with all this anti-Asian rhetoric, you know, white folk were like, eh, it's not racist, it's not a problem, it's not racist, it's not a problem. It's racist, it's a problem. You have to disrupt it. I'm going to just, you know, and I think just like, let's not center whiteness, like let's not center the murderer. Let's center these women and let it make us more interested in, you know, again, I don't want us to just be interested in Asian American women when they die. So like, let's be interested ongoingly. And I think just my sphere is the faith-based sphere. So I think continuing to like question and interrogate these like really problematic white heteropatriarchal theologies that energize some of this violence. So those are some thoughts I have.
No, I appreciate that. You know, when we talk about, I just want to get a clarity on something. When people feel like they are listening and humanizing, sometimes they do it in a token way. And I want to see if we can clarify where it's something that is really transformative. Like, not like I listened to Erna, I did my duty, did the checklist, let's move on, right? But that's why I use the word accomplice, you know, because it's like, this is a long-term struggle, and you know, and I want to see if there's a way to kind of articulate that so people know it goes above and beyond something that's very surface.
Yeah, I mean, I always feel like the great litmus test is like, have you done enough to make you feel good, or have you like done the work that the community that's being impacted is asking for, and that they feel like is actually moving things forward, right? Because I think that's the problem with white progressivism very often, is it's like, cool, I feel great about myself, I'm better than those white folk, versus like, that's not, don't compare yourself to other white folk, like center the community, and are you participating in any way that they're asking for in the work that they are doing? And I think being local matters, right? Because I think people think the work is all social media. I'm like, be local, do it on the ground right where you're at, do it relationally, do it with your money, do it with backing local leadership.
Appreciate that. Hey, Jin.
I think, you know, you all have answered so beautifully so far. I think what people can do is to continue to challenge their ideas of what it means to be Asian American, to be an immigrant in this country, or to be from a country that has been affected by American wars. And I think, you know, beyond tokenism, I think there just has to be a lot of ongoing education, self-education, and also more I suppose, like, more willingness to engage with the complexity that all these conversations bring out. And I think, you know, in terms of like tangible things, I think there's a lot of opportunities for mutual aid right now, especially given that the pandemic is ongoing. You know, we have the vaccines, but that doesn't mean everything is over, right? So I think continuing to be creative in our mutual aid efforts, and also in thinking about approaches to addressing violence that are not rooted in bringing more police in or turning more funds to the police or to having the struggle be based around like if the state is going to recognize it as a hate crime or not. Like, I don't care, you know, if it's recognized so much as a hate crime or not, when, you know, it's really the police and the military that have that are often perpetrating these kinds of violences anyway. So, but I think more about like, you know, less about what happens to the murderer and more about like, what do we do so that these folks, so that people are less vulnerable, you know?
Right.
And really thinking about those root causes. And those root causes are interconnected for all of us.
Real talk. I appreciate that. Hey, Jen, thank you. Mush, I'm gonna let you get the last word here. And I wanted you to get the last word because you started off by lifting up the names of the women that were killed. And one of the things Pastor Erna said is that maybe we need to get in the habit of not centering the criminal, you know, the murderer, but center those that were actually victims and figure out how we can uplift and build them. And you know, just as you were saying that, Pastor Erna, one of the things I was thinking about is some people do this for the notoriety. You know, it's a very macabre thing, but it's like, you know, I can be the next Hitler. I can be the next, you know, whatever terrorist name that you want to think about. And I'm going to do this and go down in infamy, and infamy should not be rewarded to any of these folks. It should be like, nobody knows your name. Nobody cares about your name. Now, doesn't mean that we don't keep our eye on making sure that they pay for justice, but their name should not be something that is the household name. I'm glad you made that point. But let's, you know, go with you. And if you can uplift those women's names again, thanks.
Yeah, thank you, baby. I'm gonna uplift and center the name of Dr. Connie Wan, who leads AAPI Women Lead. I wanna uplift the name of Liz Suk, who runs Oakland Rising. I wanna uplift the name of Michelle Kim, who is the CEO and founder of Awaken Consulting. I wanna uplift NAPOF, National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, Korean Community Center of the East Bay, Asian American Advancing Justice in Atlanta. I wanna uplift the organization Red Canary Song. Again, AAPI Women Lead. The thing that we need to do is think about strategy against oppression, against any type of supremacy as a braid. And I use the braid as a metaphor because Black women's hair is in braids. And if you go back long enough, you can see that Korean women, we would grow our hair and braid it and wrap it around our heads. And so there are different threads and strands. There's the policy strand. So by policy strand, it's like there's executive orders that are coming from the top down, from the White House. Sacramento City Council, just Council Member Mai Vong just introduced a legislation or resolution denouncing anti-Asian violence, mostly symbolic. She said it herself, right? But it passed unanimously. So it's this idea that we need to play on this metaphor and push it, play on this narrative and push it forward that we matter, because Asian women, Asian people have been taught to, we don't matter. We don't matter, because even when it comes to California, the COVID vaccine disseminations, we're not counted. Wow. We're not counted. So when you look at those and you look at census stuff, we're absolutely gone. So now is the time to say, you know what? We matter and we deserve to matter on our own accord, period. So there are policy issues that are happening. Also on an education and personal, if you are a social media person, make sure that the people that you are retweeting and reposting are people who have been long deeply embedded in this work. Understand authorship matters. If you're doing economics, advocate to disaggregate data. Because as everybody on this call said, in Oakland alone, in OUSD alone, there are 41 distinct Asian Pacific Islander ethnicity and cultural groups. In Oakland alone, 41. So disaggregate the data. And then on the last tip, which is, you know, culture, is keep telling our stories and don't be ashamed that you're taking up too much space. And this specifically is for my Asian sisters. It took me many, many, many years to believe that my story matters. And I still, because a cultural part of us defers, and we are taught to make space for others. So when, you know, my Black brothers and sisters and family are like, Mush, take the time. I will take the time. Thank you. And it's also almost impossible for me to not understand and connect my struggle to yours. It's like a constellation. I'm a narrative person. And one way to understand narratives versus stories is that story is like a single star. A constellation is like a narrative. We connect each of our stories together to create a larger narrative. And for me, that's what I'm trying to do. How do we push narratives of we matter, believe us, all of the, me too, all of those things that apply to white women.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, believe us, we're here.
I appreciate that. Can we get those names again?
Yes.
I appreciate that. I want people to remember and know and seek them out and understand those stories.
And these names, are ongoing, so please forgive me by the time you air this if some of them have been changed or reflected for accuracy. Delana Ashley Young, 33 years old. Paul Andres Michael, 54 years old. Xiao Ji Tan, 49 years old. Dao Yu Feng, 44 years old. Julie Park, age unknown. Hyunjun Park, age unknown.
There you go. I want to thank all of you all for taking time out this afternoon, especially at the last minute, to share in this conversation. Hopefully what you all said resonates with a lot of people and they take it to heart and, you know, more importantly, act upon it in a way that is, you know, impactful. So, you know, again, thank you for joining us on Hard Knock Radio. Pastor Erna, Isabel Kane, Mush, and hey, Jen, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
You're too militant. Lighten up. You're too angry. Stop complaining. Why are you complaining? Lighten up. You're too militant. Lighten up.
You don't like this country.
You're too angry.
Get out.
Stop complaining.
Stop complaining.
Why are you complaining?
Go back to where you came from.
You're too militant.
Didn't come here on the Mayflower.
You're too angry.
Just go home.
Stop complaining.
This is not your home.
Why are you complaining?
Stop getting so angry.
Don't like this country.
Stop hating America. There's no racism against
you. Stop complaining.
You're too angry.
Stop complaining. Go back to where you came from.
Why are you complaining?
Didn't come here.
You're too angry.
You're too militant.
Stop hating America. There's no racism.
What are you so mad about?
Lighten up, but what you really mean is whiten up. You wish to wash me out, melt me in your cauldron. Excuse me if I tip your melting pot, spill the shades onto your streets. I don't want to lose my color. You wonder why I get so angry and don't trust me when I claim it's your fault. Excuse me, America, you pushed for my paper permanency, shipped us as cargo for suburban missionaries.
Refugees aboard.
From a land fighting for your creed, a country in distress armed by your Congress, rampaged and pillaged, and suddenly my skin stretches on silver screens, the killing fields for your Hollywood hype. Excuse me, America, I have tried to make this my home, but you never wanted me here. 9 digits to divvy up my newfound freedom, a hyphenated identity, misconstructed name, a divided soul, Asian, American, a hybrid woman, slashed, dashed, capped, and lowercased in labels, contaminated by diction, pricked by vultures of bastard tongues. You mispronounce my pain, the sting heard on roll call days, daily friction, names slip off teachers' tongues, sounding like slaughtered soldiers caught in battalion battlefields. Excuse me for getting so angry, but you can't even say my name. Still you shuffle my anger aside, want me to bite my lips and watch my words, yet you cut me with your thoughts, Your stories frame me in fiction, recreated for ideal themes, squeezed my mind for the minor myth that molds me into your major...